The Agriculture and Rural Development Committee will come to order. We are short of quorum, so we will break into the meeting when we do have a quorum. The hour of 2:30 p.m. having arrived, we will start with House File 1050. We'll start taking testimony on that. The agenda for today, and I will announce it up front, is after having talked with Representative Ellison Lagunias, we will look at the Davids bill first, then we will discuss the two Ellison bills and the Lagunias bills. At this time, they have said that they would like a vote on them today, and I will defer to them on how they want to handle that. But about 5 after 4, or possibly 10 after 4, regardless of where we're at in the testimony, we'll split the time up between the proponents and the opponents of the three atrazine bills. We will be taking votes at that time on all three bills, so I will try and divide the time up as equally as I possibly can so that we can hear from both sides. We've spent quite a bit of committee time on the atrazine issue, and we had a very good hearing yesterday with Dr. Sass and Hayes, and there was another gentleman here.
Yaman.
I should remember that. I goofed it up. A gentleman that gave some very good testimony. So with that being said, when we do have a quorum, I'll be moving House File 1050, but I would like to start with that and start with the testimony. First of all, is there anyone in the audience that would wish to testify against the chairman's bill that helps children and the elderly? I don't see any hands. Okay, with that, we will move forward. We have with us R.J. Brown and Carla Johnson. They work with the Second Harvest, Heartland St. Paul, and Channel 1 Food Bank in Rochester. We will take their testimony, and then we will hopefully have a quorum. Now, when nobody wants to vote or testify against something, this committee is best just to kind of cut and run. So we want to hear what the bill does, hear what you're trying to do, or hear what we're trying to do, and then we'll move forward with it. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Brown, Second Harvest Heartlands, and I am here to speak in support of House File 1050. What it does is provides funding for the purchase of milk that would be distributed to over 1,000 social service agencies throughout the state of Minnesota through the food bank network. There are 6 food banks that serve all of Minnesota. And a combination of products, over 40 million pounds was moved through our system last year. We have had a supply of milk in the past. 250,000 gallons of milk came through a legal settlement, and that ended last November. Since that time, we have been unable to provide milk to the agencies that we serve, and those agencies include food shelves, on-site feeding programs for seniors, for youth, and also shelters, missions, other organizations that feed the needy. I don't think I need to tell an agriculture committee the importance of milk, both to our physical well-being as well as to the economy. In a state that's one of our leading producers of milk in the country, it's unconscionable that there are some of our citizens who don't have access to it. So I ask for your support of funding to purchase milk.
Mr. Chair.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Carla Johnson. I'm the executive director of Channel 1 Food Bank and Food Shelf in Rochester, Minnesota. Channel 1 distributes industry and government surplus food through a network of 179 agency programs in 87 nonprofit charities. 35 of those agencies are food shelves. Those are the local programs where people get supplemental food that helps stretch their household resources each month. Over the past year, in our area alone, the food shelves have seen and served a 21% increase in service overall. More people than ever are having a tough time making ends meet. At the food shelf in Preston, where Representative David lives, more than 400 of his neighbors, children, working moms and dads, and the elderly, regularly benefit from the additional nutrition that the food from the food shelf in his area provides. In Olmsted County, where Channel 1 Food Shelf operates 5 different sites for people to get food, more than 7,000 people in 2,300 families supplement their household resources by a visit to a food shelf each month. We help these households to not have to choose between paying rent or buying food, between paying their utility bills or providing food for their families, between paying for prescription medications or having food on the table. We know that the more nutritious food we can provide, the healthier all the members in those families will be. We know that with adequate nutrition, children will grow up to be strong and will be alert for learning. We know that our elderly will have better long-term health and may be able to live independently longer. We know that working moms and dads will know that they have more options for keeping their families well. In closing, I'd like to share these words from Susan, a shopper at the Channel 1 food shelf, who says this: I'm so grateful for Channel 1. There are many times that we may have gone hungry without your program. We enjoy the treats we receive, but it's so much better when the food shelf has essentials like milk, flour, and sugar. Milk is such a huge expense to our family. With four kids, we go through it fast, and it's a daily concern. My husband and I are both disabled. Our food stamps are just not quite enough. I'm going to return to school this spring, so we still have some hope. Thank you for your help. Thank you all to the committee members and you, Mr. Chair, for providing this bill that can provide milk to our families.
Thank you so much. Any questions of either of the witnesses? Okay, we now officially do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the Agricultural and Rural Development Committee meeting to order. I will now, Representative Welty moves the minutes of March 15, 2005. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Welty. We now have, I will move House File 1050 be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Agriculture and Environmental, what's that thing called? Finance. Agricultural and Environmental Finance Committee, and Natural Resources and all those types of things. Any questions for the witnesses? Hearing none, I'll renew my motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you so much. We go to the next stop now.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will be working on splitting up the time here. If Representatives Ellison and Wagenius could be so kind as to come to the table. We have before us House File 1246, House File 1248, House File 1224, and I don't think we can move three bills at the same time, so I'm going to ask if any members would like to move. We'll start with the one that's on the first on their House File 1246.
Mr. Shelby, I'll be happy to move that bill.
Okay, Representative Johnson moves House File 1246 to be recommended pass and sent to the House floor. House floor? General Register? We can figure that out as we go along here. Okay, so with that, Representative Ellison and Representative Wagenius, welcome to the committee. We're going to basically let you take it from here for about the next half hour. And actually, members, what we'll be doing, this, I don't know if this is kind of an odd way to do it, but we're going to try and do it this way because we want to get as much time for testimony from both sides. So when we shut her down about 10 after 4, we will be moving House File 1246. We have that in front of us now, and then 1248, and then 1224. So with that, I do want to make sure there's a gentleman from Winona that drove up yesterday. And so in the proponent's time, Representative Wagenius and Ellison have a Jeanette Brimmer and a Dr. David Wallinga. Did I say that right? Okay, Dr. David Wallinga. There's also a gentleman from Winona, Jim Riddle, who came up. So I would like on the proponent's time some time for Mr. Riddle. So we will make time for him. And then we'll have questions. We'll be cutting the proponents off at about, well, we'll figure that out. Give you about half. How much time we got? Oh, we got longer than that. We can go about. We'll figure it out. You got some time here. We'll give you as much time as we can. Representative Ellison.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, that there is another testifier named Gloria Contreras who I thought we forwarded, but maybe we didn't.
Okay,
she is
just,
here.
That's just fine. We'll put, it's Gloria
Contreras.
How do you spell that? You know,
C-O-N-T-R-A-R-A-T-R-S.
Okay, we'll get that defined when she's up here.
And also,
who does she represent?
She is with the Centro Campesino in Owatonna. It's an organization of migrant farm workers.
Okay.
And she will need the assistance of a language interpreter.
Okay, super.
Okay.
Anybody else? That'd be just fine. Okay, so that's the way we'll do it. I do want to guarantee that Mr. Riddle, who drove back up from Monona, is also on the agenda. And then we've got some opponents that will present their testimony. So that, welcome the committee. Who wants to take the lead, Representative Wagenius or Ellison, whoever?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will start, and thank you all for having us.
If you could please present Representative Ellison's bill.
Pardon?
Please, right. This is kind of, go ahead and start, and we'll work it from here.
Well, I think since the testimony fits all three bills, and the bills that you have before us are three different choices of ways to handle what we see as the atrazine problem, so we thought we would provide the testimony, and then you look at your options.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius.
All right. I'm just going to start for a second and do an introduction, and then Representative Ellison will talk, then Ms. Bremer will talk, and then we'll just go from there. I want to start by reminding you that 1 million Minnesotans get their drinking water from private wells. These wells are rarely tested and rarely treated. These wells belong to your constituents. Atrazine is getting into groundwater that is the water supply for these wells. We don't know how much the wells are contaminated, how many are contaminated, or how much they're contaminated by, but we do know this. We know that 21,000 wells were tested for nitrates by the Department of Agriculture. And in vulnerable areas, 40% of them had more nitrates than would be the natural background level. So why is that important? Because if nitrates can get into a well, then so can atrazine. But we've never looked at these wells for atrazine, and we haven't told the residents to check their wells for atrazine. And why not? The Minnesota Department of Agriculture is fond of saying that they see very low levels of atrazine in our waters. Of course, what they call very low levels of atrazine is because the standard they are using for measuring is the weakest standard in the world. Think about that for a minute. The Minnesota health risk limit for atrazine is 20 parts per billion for the citizens in your communities. Now, for the citizens in my community on the Minneapolis drinking water system, it's 3 parts per billion. Your constituents can have 20 parts per billion in their wells. And just keep in mind that male frogs can become female when exposed to 0.5 parts per billion. The 20 parts per billion standard is way out of date, and that is why it is the weakest standard in the world. An Iowa study showed that a 2 to 3-fold increase in birth defects when atrazine was found in drinking water of concentrations of less than 2 parts per billion. That's one of the many studies I could talk to you about, but there is no study. There is not one study that says that atrazine is safe for kids. As legislators, we cannot in good conscience tell the moms and dads in Minnesota that it is okay for kids to have atrazine in their drinking water. We cannot in good conscience tell the moms and dads that it's okay for Minnesota children to have atrazine with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it's our job to make sure the atrazine doesn't get in the drinking water. Thus far, our management practices have not worked. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture has declared that atrazine is in common detection. They did so in 1990 and reaffirmed it again in 2002. And that means, of course, that when it is applied according to directions, it ends up in the groundwater. This is a practical problem. We are a practical people, and we ought to be solving this practical problem. However, doing more of the same is not the solution. In any event, no one has asked for the huge amount of money it would take to do more of the same on a very large scale. Wisconsin has worked hard to keep atrazine out of its groundwater, and I borrowed heavily from it when I was writing House File for 1224. The bill is not a ban, but it does impose restrictions where atrazine is getting into the groundwater. The possibility of restrictions, of course, is the incentive to keep atrazine out of the groundwater. That is one of your three bills before you. Representative Ellison will now talk to you about the other two.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Fellow legislators, I come before you as a person who is concerned about kids, water drinkers. I'm concerned about the lives of all Minnesotans, not just urbanites in my own district. I'm concerned about people in Minnesotans from rural Minnesota, and I'm concerned about farmers. I'm also concerned about not only one sector of our economy in the state of Minnesota, but also all sectors, which would include the sector that depends on tourism and fishing and our water resource. It's true that I don't have a lot of farmers in House District 58B, North Minneapolis. But it's also true that we got a lot of water drinkers in North Minneapolis. And it's also true that I'm concerned about all Minnesotans. And it's also true that I'm concerned about all farm families. I'm concerned about migrant farm workers who you will hear from one of their representatives today who deal directly with this, who Dr. Hayes showed are probably urinating out 24,000 times the amount of atrazine it takes to hermaphrodite a frog. And I'm also here concerned about our general health and welfare. I want to set my comments again in the framework of the 60 years it took for us to figure out that lead paint wasn't good for us. The decades it took to learn that Ford Pintos were designed improperly. The decades that it took to figure out asbestos is something we needed to deal with and regulate. And to say, look, from the very beginning, our kids here in Minnesota are just as good as any kids in France, Germany, Liechtenstein, or any European country where atrazine is banned. It is banned there. You can't use it there. And the company that produces it is a European company, which I think is quite interesting from the very beginning. I think it's important to note that our neighbors are restricting it more carefully. And I think that if you reflect upon what Dr. Tyrone Hayes had to say yesterday, that it's clear that even though atrazine may be cheap and it may actually kill weeds, the cost of continuing to use it is higher than we can afford. And so my bills are simple. One is to ban it now. Ban it. Do what the Europeans do. If it's not good enough for them, it's not good enough for us. And my other bill is to ban it in 3 years in a phase-out, because I do recognize that, you know, there are some growers who need it, who use it, and who feel that it is important for them, so that they may want to use it, get rid of it on a more graduated scale. But those are my two bills. They're about as simple as you can get. And I know that there will be some questions, and I look forward to the give and take of that period. But I do look forward to you hearing from Ms. Gloria Contreras, whose friends and family every day work in the cornfields in Minnesota, work hard every day, many of whom have migrated here to eke out a living, but who are exposed to an endocrine disrupting chemical that threatens the health, their health and the health of their children. So that's what I have to say, and at this point I'm ready to do the testifiers, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Or answer questions.
Mr. Ellison. I think we'll go on to the testifiers first, and I will now. The first person is Jeanette K. Brimmer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you want to present your testimony uninterrupted, or can we interrupt you? Well, it's up to you.
It probably flows best if we do it uninterrupted, and then we can take questions and have to take questions afterwards.
That's what we'll do then. Thank you so much. Please
Thank
state
you.
Your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. Technical question. Do I hit the laptop button here?
I have no clue. Jennifer, tell.
We need someone under 30.
Thank you. You know, I just turned 46, and my wife said, well, now we can round that to 50. And I said, no, we can't. That's 46. Don't do any rounding here.
Okay. Taxes.
Yeah.
Representative Davids, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Jeanette Brimmer. I am both the legal director and in a nonprofit. You wear a lot of hats. So I'm also the manager of the pesticide project for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I may very well have seen some of you in this committee in the past and some of these things, and I'm glad to be back. We're going to talk, I hope I can move through this fairly quickly today, but let me just outline for you our presentation. We've been working pesticide issues for quite some time now. I would say over 5 years, pretty intensively. And let me be clear, especially given some of the questions yesterday, we are not about banning all chemical use. We are not about organic farming as the only way. What we are interested in having Minnesota do is move to smarter, more protective ways of regulating and using pesticides. I think that there are ways that we can look at less toxic options without getting rid of all of them altogether. We will talk to you about some of those sort of broader issues, and then we will talk about why atrazine is before you right now as a perfect poster child, as the example of how we need to sort of move into the next generation of how we look at pesticides and how we regulate them in a more careful manner. Okay, that's not going to work. There we go. Scientific evidence, as the committee heard yesterday, significantly links pesticide exposure in humans to a variety of health problems. There is published in the scientific literature links to stillbirth, spontaneous abortion, birth defects, cancer in children, cancer in adults. You'll hear a little bit more about some details there from Dr. Wallinga. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, Parkinson's disease, and impaired neural development in children. Now, not all of these are atrazine, but atrazine does play a role in some of these health effects, as you heard yesterday. We sell about 29 million pounds of pesticide active ingredients, most recently in 2003. I can't tell you how much is actually applied. All we have are sales records because, despite some legislative directive to do so, that's all that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture keeps track of. We don't really have detailed information on what's aerially applied, what goes on the ground, what goes on the plants or used in buildings, anywhere else really for that matter. Of those that are sold, however, in 2003 is the most recent year we have information. This is all from the Department of Agriculure here in Minnesota. 8.1 million pounds are endocrine disruptors. You heard a lot about what endocrine disruptors do yesterday. Atrazine is one of those. Chlorpyrifos is one of those. And let me just raise that quickly because there's some interest there. Chlorpyrifos is actually on the decline. It's an insecticide. It's the pesticide that Jennifer Sass was talking about yesterday, where when they banned it partially and quit using it in buildings, we've actually seen significant gains in the health of infants. And again, Dr. Wallinger will talk about that in some detail. But it's still used in agriculture. It's not banned in agriculture. And it's been used on the soybean aphid in Minnesota most recently. From 2002 to 2003, we saw a jump. Let me make sure I get my... This is also from the Department of Agriculture. 2002, we sold 313,000 pounds of chlorpyrifos. In 2003, we sold 1.12 million. And that's a pesticide that has proven health effects on children. So again, I just want the committee to be aware of kind of the magnitude of what's going on here. 6.7 million pounds of probable carcinogens, 3.6 million pounds of reproductive or developmental toxins. Not to ignore wildlife, we heard a lot about frogs yesterday, some about fish. 1.2 million pounds are toxic to mammals, which of course has some meaning for humans because that's where we do a lot of our human research. 1.3 million toxic to bees. And you probably heard a little bit about beekeepers having trouble with carbaryl and hybrid poplars in west central Minnesota. That too is a part of our agriculture industry, beekeepers. And they are losing their livelihood to insecticide use in Minnesota. 8 million pounds toxic to fish, another important industry here in Minnesota I want to point out. Tourism and fishing is critical. I think both Representatives Wagenius and Ellison pointed out, our history is not a happy one with respect to toxins. Up there is just a few of examples of toxins where, for a long time, we toddled along thinking everything was fine, and the research, the more it came out, the more we realized we were exposing our children and ourselves to deadly toxins, and those sort of so-called safe limits continue to go down. The more we know, the more we know we cannot be exposed to these kinds of toxins. And I think that there is some evidence of that same thing happening for a number of pesticides, including atrazine. What I want to show you here a little is sort of a lead into the next several slides. What we've got here is a map of the state of Minnesota. The red triangles are Department of Agriculture's groundwater monitoring network, primarily in the central sand plains. This too is straight from Department of Agriculture's website. The purple dots are surface water monitoring sites. Interestingly, compare that to the shaded counties, which are the top five producing counties, according to USDA statistics, for our top four crops, corn, sugar beets, wheat, and soybeans. And, of course, corn being the biggest user of atrazine. So it's not really all that relevant, as you'll see later, that we're hearing that, well, maybe, over the last year or so, atrazine in groundwater is going down. We're not really monitoring groundwater where we're probably seeing some of the heaviest atrazine use. Right. So let's talk about that, pesticides and groundwater. I've got a little bit of a review of the data for you here. U.S. Geological Survey, Red River Valley, did a pretty intensive study. 52% of the samples contain pesticides. Sherburne County, as you know, that's an urbanizing area where a lot of people are putting in private wells. And that's what they're getting their drinking water from. 86% of the samples had at least one pesticide. PCA did a single study of Cottage Grove, also was an agricultural area, now becoming far more urbanized. 68% of the private well samples contained pesticides. Similar study in St. Cloud, 64%. We've got some research from the Department of Agriculture. Every year they are monitoring in the sand plains there, reporting that. You can get that data off their website. They're actually doing a really good job of at least making that information available. In 2003, 79% of the samples contained atrazine. I want to point out again, Department of Agriculture recently reported atrazine is declining in the sand plains. Up through 2003, that was not correct. If you look at their information, that percentage of the samples containing atrazine was on the increase. So if we've got any kind of trend at all, I would submit to the committee, it's a one-year trend, not much of a trend, really. Let's turn to surface water, because of course groundwater is only part of the picture. There are plenty of us drinking groundwater. There are also plenty of us drinking surface water. The Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul drink Mississippi water. There are a number of surface waters throughout the state that are listed by PCA as being protected as potential drinking water sources. Again, U.S. Geological Survey, right here in town, we've got Lake Harriet in Minneapolis, a stormwater outfall to the lake. Atrazine concentration sampled above that EPA 3 parts per billion limit. In three south central watersheds and agricultural areas, they found atrazine in 100% of the samples. Here's what I'd really like to concentrate on is some of the recent information from surface water in southeast Minnesota from the Department of Agriculture. Again, you want to look at trends. This is a trend that is disturbing in the southeast surface waters. 2001, you found atrazine and acetochlor at every single station monitored, betalachlor and 2,4-D in all but one. 2002, now every station has atrazine, acetochlor, metallochlor, 2,4-D and dicamba. 2003, there's still shown up at every station, same for 2004. One difference, as indicated on the slide, is Department of Agriculture quit reporting on 2,4-D and dicamba, so I can't tell you what happened there. And we use the Whitewater as a perfect example, and the Whitewater River for atrazine. The Whitewater River in the southeast part of the state has several branches. It's actually a good example because Department of Agriculture maintains a regular monitoring station up there, and they have data going back quite a while in the Whitewater. The Whitewater River is a designated trout stream. The Whitewater River has a state park on it with a swimming beach. And the Whitewater River is listed as a drinking water source by Pollution Control Agency and is required to be protected as a drinking water source. Largely because in that southeast part of the state, you all know about the karst topography, the fractured limestone, surface and groundwater exchange quite readily. So you could think that you're drinking from the Whitewater and you're really drinking somewhere else and vice versa. In other words, your well could have been Whitewater River water yesterday in the southeast part of the state. In 2001, we just put some samples up there, and in red you'll see the EPA and PCA human health limits. And I put up one part per billion because we're involved in revising our groundwater health limits right now, and NCEA's public health scientist has fully reviewed the data and applied Department of Health's methodology, and it is our recommendation that the human health standard for atrazine be one part per billion. And I just want you as that frame of reference so that you can see what's going on. In the course of several days, you can see that the Whitewater River was well exceeding one part per billion. It was even exceeding three parts per billion on at least one occasion. 2002, not a good year for atrazine in the Whitewater. If you were drinking Whitewater River water during a couple of those months in June of 2002, and you were vulnerable, you were a child, you were a fetus, you were an expectant mother, you were not in a very good situation, especially given what Dr. Hayes was telling us yesterday about the hormone system and how that can be impacted. And you can see we've got 29.4 parts per billion during one rainstorm event. I will tell you that those high numbers tend to be rainstorm events because, of course, things that you put on the ground aren't going to get into surface water unless they're washing off. But with the short exposures that you can see results from atrazine, this is something to be concerned about. 2003, Department of Ag tells us, was a fairly dry year. It looked like we had some real limited sampling in 2003, but nonetheless, we've got some pretty high rates there, well above the EPA standard. 2004, we got a world record, 32 parts per billion in June of 2004. Again, 3 parts per billion is the human health standard. And look at that for several samples in a row there. You're very, very high. For June 15th to the 25th, you're pretty much above the human health standard the entire time. Again, pregnant mom drinking that water would not be real happy. I'm going to move through this next piece quickly. This is Representative Atrenda's bill, which we're not taking up today, but just to let you know, hopefully we'll get a chance to visit with you about giving people access to pesticide application records so they can know and understand what's going on around them. Let's get through this. Go ahead. One more. So let's talk about what we're here today. We're here with several options for addressing atrazine, atrazine being, as I said, a poster child for our failure to be as protective as we could be.
Excuse me, Ms. Brimmer.
Mm-hmm.
I've split the time up 45 minutes for each side. You're good till 3:25, and we've got three other people to testify. So how many slides do you have yet?
About three.
Oh, well, let's continue. Why are you waiting?
Thanks for checking in.
Yes.
Just to remind the committee, Department of Agriculture is required by statute. You've instructed them to analyze the unreasonable adverse impacts to human health and the environment in Minnesota of all pesticides to be registered in Minnesota. Unfortunately, Department of Agriculture is unable to carry that out right now, or maybe unwilling, but at any rate, it does not have children's health experts on staff, doesn't have toxicologists on staff, and as you heard at a hearing earlier this session, Department of Agriculture is not engaging in that independent review. They said, we simply collect the fee and rely on EPA. And as you heard yesterday, EPA is not so reliable on these things. And I want to point out Wisconsin example. You've heard a lot about that, but it really is important. I take seriously concerns about competitiveness. Do we want to remove something from our farmers' use and have them competing with Illinois farmers, Wisconsin farmers, Iowa farmers? Do we want to put them at a disadvantage? And I want to point out, both Wisconsin and Iowa have already taken steps on atrazine. One of the handouts that we made available to you is from Wisconsin Rules, and that shows atrazine prohibition areas in Wisconsin, and if you go on their website and look at that, you can actually pull up even more detail. Those darkened areas on that map are where atrazine is prohibited, cannot be used at all. And similar to one of Representative Ellison's bills that is before you today, there are other areas where atrazine is limited. In other words, you can only apply it at perhaps half the label rate or at a certain number of pounds per acre below the maximum allowed label rate. And those, also similar to one of Representative Ellison's bills, are tied directly to sensitive water resources. In other words, water resources that are trout streams or that are particularly vulnerable because of possibly steep slopes or a particular geology. You also see prohibition areas in Wisconsin in areas closer to urban centers. So in other words, people that are in the growing Madison area, people in the growing Green Bay area that may be building out into agricultural areas, Wisconsin is protecting the groundwater in those areas. So it's very similar to some of the options that are before the committee today. And Wisconsin reports that it's a success, that their groundwater atrazine levels are reducing, and not just a one-year trend. It's really reducing, and it's really making a difference. Iowa has some similar both prohibition areas and atrazine limitation areas, and both of them do it by rule. So before you today are several different options. Representative Wagenius's bill ties it directly to the groundwater resource. Is your water safe to drink? If it's not, we better be doing something about it. We better not add to the problem by putting more atrazine on the land. Representative Ellison's bills cut right to the point. One just says, this isn't worth messing with anymore, and I think that that makes some sense. The other is a phase-out bill patterned after some of what you are seeing, some of the decision-making in Wisconsin and Iowa. What are the sensitive resources? What do we need to protect? What is the best way to go about that? And it gives some time to move in that direction. We basically support all of these approaches as sort of the new wave, the best way to start making smart decisions about pesticide use and registration in Minnesota. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry, one other thing. If you want a really fancy color map, I was not able to make copies of this, but if I can show you this, this is Wisconsin's groundwater map. All the dots are where they have tested. Okay, compare that to our map. And these dots show where they are finding atrazine, and it also talks about the prohibition area. So I can make this available if anyone is interested. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's now go on to the testimony of Dr. David Wallinga, and then we're going to fit Jim Riddle, and then we're going to fit Gloria Contreras in there, and I'll be done by 3:25 with the members having asked questions.
Thank you, Chairman David. Well, just by way of introduction, my name is David Wallinga. I'm a physician trained here at Minnesota. For the last 7 or 8 years, I've been doing work around pesticide regulation and human health impacts of pesticides, and I just recently completed a term on the Science Advisory Board to the EPA on their Human Exposure Committee. So I'm going to talk about the dilemma facing you all, which is protecting health and at the same time not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot about the science, and yet I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that maybe this would be a controversial decision. Why is that? Well, the science is, and yet I still think that it would behoove public health in order to move forward to take some of the steps that the preceding speakers have proposed. And why is that? Because the science is good. In fact, it's surprisingly good given all the hurdles to developing science that exist in the current regulatory scheme for pesticides. And I'm just going to put some things in the context of the federal pesticide regulatory scheme. Proof is a moving target, and scientific proof can be elusive for a lot of reasons. I just wanted to throw this up here. When the CEO of Philip Morris was here a few years ago, he said, I'm unclear in my own mind whether anyone dies of cigarettes. So this is just to say that scientific proof can be a moving target sometimes. as Jeanette Brimmer said, atrazine is something of a poster child or a case study for some general problems of our pesticide regulatory scheme. And what I would say is that that regulatory system is constructed in such a way that crucial information about the health risks or possible health risks of pesticides often are not collected at all, or they're slow to be collected, or they're collected only after people have already been injured. And I think it's reasonable to say that from a public health standpoint, that's what we want to prevent, right? So the dilemma is that we have a regulatory system that was really put in place decades ago, and yet the science that you've been hearing about is recent. Science evolves quickly. Regulatory systems don't. So one of the byproducts of this decades-old regulatory system is that we've got now got almost 900 registered active ingredients. But they were that scheme was set up in an era when we really didn't worry about too much other than acute poisonings. We didn't really think to do any environmental monitoring. We didn't put in place any system for monitoring health impacts or disease. And so we weren't really worried about anyone other than maybe the farmer applicators. We didn't think about children in urban areas or women's breast milk or the fetus and the environment that the fetus is in. So just to go to a couple of specifics of why we're having to change our way of thinking. DDT, of course, was banned in the 70s. Okay, it's only recently that we've become aware of the health harm caused by DDT exposure. Matt Longnecker is a government scientist. A few years ago, he went back and he looked at stored blood from women that were pregnant in the 1960s, and he looked at a metabolite of DDT in their blood and compared it with what we know about what happened to that pregnancy. And what he found was that women who were using DDT had an increased risk of preterm birth. That's important because that's a risk factor for infant death. Okay? And the higher the concentration of the DDT metabolite in the mom, the smaller the baby's size. And he concluded that DDT use could have been responsible for 15% of infant deaths during the 1960s. This is in The Lancet, major medical journal. Second case study, chlorpyrifos, we've heard that mentioned. It was the most common insecticide used in the year 2000 before EPA took some steps to reduce the use. It was used as a termiticide in the home. It was widely used around the home. It was also used in crops and still is. EPA only negotiated with the manufacturer to reduce some of those uses after the company submitted a study on the effects on the developing animal. Not human data, animal data. Okay? Wasn't a required test, it was a voluntary test. So it wasn't until a few years later that we started to get more human data. This was a study where they looked at meconium, the first stool coming out of a baby after it's born, and they looked for metabolites that are common to chlorpyrifos and other organophosphate insecticides. 19 out of the 20 infants whose meconium they looked at had measurable amounts of neurotoxic insecticides in their meconium. So they're getting fetal exposure. Okay, we know that. Well, a few years later, what did they do? They went back and they looked at some of the same sorts of assessments of newborns after those EPA phase-outs had taken place. And lo and behold, I'll just read this from the New York Times, pregnant women who were heavily exposed to Durzban and diazinon, chlorpyrifos and diazinon had smaller babies than their neighbors, but recent restrictions on the two lowered exposure and increased the baby's size. Here's the actual scientific study in the NIH journal Environmental Health Perspectives. And if you can't read it at the bottom, they said, these findings support recent regulatory actions to phase out residential use of the insecticides. The results indicate that prenatal exposure to chlorpyrifos did impair fetal growth. So this kind of human data only comes out after the fact because the system's not designed to generate it. Human studies are expensive. They're not done by the pesticide manufacturers, and so they're hard to get. And so the information only comes after the fact, and yet farm use in Minnesota, as you heard, is going up of chlorpyrifos. This is just to say, I don't think this is coming out very clearly, but these are the years of registration of various organophosphate insecticides. Here's chlorpyrifos, 1965.
some of the other ones like malathione and diazinon were registered quite a bit earlier. The point here is that it took 30 to 40 years to reach this point. Just let me talk a little bit about pesticides and cancer. We're lucky with respect to cancer because, unlike other chronic diseases, we actually track cancer. And the National Institutes of Health generate maps of cancer incidence. And so one of the ones that's been specifically associated with pesticide use is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the upper Midwest has been noted as being something of a hot spot. So these are deaths from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from 1970 to 1994. And just note that the incidence seems to be climbing every year about 1% to 1.5%. Here's Minnesota's statistics. You'll note that the mortality rate in Minnesota is significantly higher than the U.S. as a whole. Well,
Doctor, how much more do you have? What's happening here? I've got two testifiers for 10 minutes.
I've got about three more slides.
Okay.
It worked last time, right?
Awesome.
So the first comprehensive review of pesticide literature and human health effects that I know of was done by the Ontario College of Family Physicians this past year. They actually looked at hundreds of studies. They put out a 180-page report. They zeroed in on a couple of specific health endpoints, including non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They found that of the 27 studies that they deemed of high quality, 23 showed an association between pesticide exposure and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Prostate cancer, again, there's a very significant geographic association here. We're not exactly sure why, but the northern states seem to have more of it. This is the change over time. So you see the prostate deaths from prostate cancer in 1950 to 1969 on the left-hand side, and then on the right-hand side, the increase. And here's the Minnesota data. Again, mortality rates higher in Minnesota. And you heard yesterday from Dr. Sass about a couple of recent human studies. Again, it takes decades to get human data, showing that there's a significantly higher risk of prostate cancer among Hispanic farm workers. And you're going to hear from a woman representing that community who are exposed to triazine herbicides. And then there's the atrazine factory study. Syngenta has data of showing, according to Dr. Sass, an up to nine-fold greater increase in cancer among the workers in that plant in Louisiana. And so, just to skip over this, that Ontario study concluded that all the commonly used pesticides show positive associations with adverse health effects. The literature does not support the concept that some pesticides are safer than others necessarily. And our message to patients as physicians should be to focus on reducing exposure whenever we can. And I would add that that's particularly true when you find a persistent pesticide in your drinking water source, because we know we all have to drink water, right? It's a little hard to avoid that. So unlike cancer, we don't really monitor for other chronic diseases at a national level. We have no ability to track hormone disruption. We have no ability to track birth defects at a national level. We have no ability to track learning disabilities. So we're really in the dark about whether those are going up or not, although there is some suggestive evidence. So just to summarize and to finish, what is the dilemma facing you as our state's legislators? If our federal pesticide regulatory system only recognizes the health impacts on humans of pesticides, or considers those associations to be proven after people have been harmed in great enough numbers that it makes it terribly obvious, then you as policymakers, I think, should be thinking really hard before we ignore the early warning signs where credible science shows pesticides like the organophosphates in meconium, like atrazine in drinking water, like persistence in breast milk, or animal studies where these same compounds are harming mammals or even amphibians like frogs. And I'll finish up there with the take-home message, which is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Doctor. We'll now go to Gloria Contreras. I believe we need an interpreter here. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mi nombre es Gloria N. Contreras.
My name is Gloria M. Contreras.
Gracias, representante Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Representative Mr. Davis.
Chair, members of the committee.
The chair of the committee and all the members of the committee.
Es un honor para mí estar aquí.
It's an honor for me to be here.
Y gracias por compartir con, que me dejen compartir algo de mí.
And thank you for allowing me to share something of me.
Actualmente yo trabajo en Centro Campesino.
Right now I work with Centro Campesino, which means Farm Workers Center.
Y trabajo en un programa de salud.
And I work in a program, a health-related program.
Y es prevención de salud.
And I work especially in prevention, health prevention, disease prevention.
Voy a hablar de 10 años atrás.
I'm going to start by talking about 10 years ago.
Cuando yo venía a los campos migrantes.
When I came, I first started coming to the migrant camps.
Y yo no sabía si los pesticidas hacían mal o no.
I didn't know if pesticides were bad or good.
Recuerdo que mis niños jugaban.
I remember my children playing.
Debajo de los, cuando pasaban los aeroplanos.
Underneath the planes when the airplanes would come by.
Y jugaban. Yo no sé si están enfermos ahorita o no.
My children played when pesticides were being applied by airplane. I'm not sure if they're sick from that or not.
Y todos mis compañeros de trabajo es lo mismo. No sabían.
My colleagues, we all passed through the same type of thing. We didn't know if pesticides were good or bad. We were working in the field.
Lo que nosotros veníamos era a trabajar.
What we came to do here to Minnesota was to work. That was it.
Pasado el tiempo.
As time passed. I also began to work with the health promoter, community health worker program. And it began to seem very sad and very ironic that I was working in this health prevention program and I was still in all this contact with pesticides. And we'd see the airplanes and we'd say, you know, hello and goodbye to the airplanes.
Un día nosotros dijimos, pero ¿qué es lo que estamos haciendo? Si estamos trabajando en salud.
One day we started to ask ourselves, what is it that we're doing if we're working in health?
Y no estamos haciendo nada para evitar que respiremos, olemos, o lo que sea.
And we're not doing anything to think about what are we touching, what are we breathing, what are we in contact with.
Hicimos una carta donde todos firmamos que la próxima vez que hicieran pesticidas,
we put together a letter asking that the next time the pesticides were going to be applied, that they would please advise us before that happened. And it resulted in that change. Each time that they applied pesticides, and especially close to where we lived, they would be advised. My worry now.
Hace 10 años nosotros no sabíamos si era bueno o malo, solo veníamos a trabajar.
Yes, about 10 years ago we didn't know if it was good or bad, we just came here to work.
Actualmente.
No.
La gente sigue en lo mismo.
People continue working. People continue working and don't know.
Cuando viene la gente de los, a los campos migrantes.
When people come to Minnesota to the migrant camps.
Y vienen y viven más o menos.
Many people come and live.
Si no, que vamos a destruirlo. Si quieres parar, yo sigo traduciendo.
Is it all right if she walks and I translate, so it can be on the record?
Let's have a page handout so she can continue here.
Okay. Y esto es cerca de los fields.
Mm-hmm. This is a migrant camp that is located in rural Minnesota, close to the fields.
Sigue viniendo la gente trabajando.
People are continually recruited to Minnesota, come here to work in Minnesota agriculture.
Vienen como de 25,000 a 30,000 migrantes cada año.
25,000 to 30,000 migrant farm workers come to Minnesota each year.
Solo vienen a trabajar, trabajan en quitando la piedra.
People come here to work. People now work in rock picking.
Quitando las hierbas malas.
Weeding.
Quitando la espiga del.
And detasseling in corn.
En todas las clases de trabajo de la vida rural.
Vegetable canning and all the different seasonal agricultural work that is available in Minnesota.
La preocupación de ahora de nosotros.
Our worry now.
Es no sabemos qué tantos químicos y pesticidas hay en el área donde trabajan.
We don't know exactly how many pesticides or chemicals are there in the places where we work and live.
Solo sabemos.
We only know.
Que nosotros descansamos.
That we rest. On top of the fields.
Comemos.
We eat in the fields.
Y no tenemos. Como dije, la preocupación mía es salud.
As I said, my worry is our health.
Y es bien difícil decir no estén diciendo no estén usando pesticidas.
And it's very difficult to say don't use pesticides.
Porque por un lado está la salud.
Because at one side we have health.
Y por otro lado, y los niños. Que
and the children that are here in the fields. And that are living in the fields, living in rural areas. And I have to remember that my children didn't have, it wasn't their fault that I came to work, and so it wasn't their fault that they were exposed to the pesticides.
Entonces, ¿qué se debería hacer?
So what should be done?
Por una parte, si quizás el trabajo de la comunidad.
We understand that it's very important. We don't want to take work away from our community.
No sé, tal vez una manera de trabajar juntos y poner, no sé, tal vez. Yo no digo que usen pesticidas, pero también nosotros no sabíamos que nos estaban envenenando.
Yes, what I want to make clear is that we need to work together as a rural community. We need the work, we need agriculture, and at the same time, we didn't know that we were being poisoned, and it's not okay to have the pesticides.
Es todo. Yo no quiero que haya pesticidas, pero sí quiero que haya trabajo.
It's everything, and I understand, but I don't want there to be pesticides, and I want there to be a rural economy and work.
Thank you so much. Thank you for testifying. It's 3:25, so Mr. Riddle, you'll have to wait till tomorrow to testify. Just kidding. Please join us. We'll make it up on the other end here somehow. And I do thank you for coming back from Winona today, since we couldn't get you on yesterday. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please, sir,
yes,
and provide your testimony.
My name is Jim Riddle from Winona, and I'm chair of the USDA's National Organic Standards Board and chair of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Organic Advisory Task Force, but I do not represent or speak on behalf of either USDA or MDA. I'm offering my own comments. I also work as a writer for the Rodale Institute's newfarm.org magazine, and I've been an organic inspector for 18 years. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would just like to commend you on hearing these bills and also thank the authors for bringing them forward. This is a very important topic. And I would also like to thank this committee for your historic support over the years of organic agriculture. And I understand there will be a bill later introduced for some funding for the Minnesota Institute for Sustainable Agriculture, and I encourage your support. It's doing excellent work. I would also like to report that the market for organic products continues to grow at a rate of 20% a year, with U.S. sales exceeding $13 billion in 2004. And here in Minnesota, there were 38,000 new acres converted to organic production in 2002 under an NRCS EQIP Organic Transition Incentive Program. And Minnesota leads the nation in production of organic corn, soybeans, and total dry beans. In fact, the organic market is the fastest growing sector of the food industry, and more farmers are converting. In fact, the 2004 Minnesota Farm Bureau Young Farmer of the Year award winner, Jonathan Olson, is an organic farmer. But we're not here today to talk about the growth of organic. We're here talking about the regulation of atrazine and changing farm practices. And I understand that it's not easy to change farm practices. I've been working in that area for 18 years. But the human tendency is always to resist change, to maintain the status quo, to stick with what works. Don't rock the boat. Change is difficult. But as you know, atrazine is banned in Europe, and its use is banned and restricted in Wisconsin and in Iowa. And farmers in those regions have adapted and even thrived, and there are alternative practices which do exist. A 10-year study published by the University of Minnesota, and I do have one copy of that study here for the record that I can leave with you, showed in southwest Minnesota at Lamberton that a four-year rotation using organic practices produced equivalent yields consistently over 10 years compared to a 2-year conventional rotation of corn and beans using herbicides. And I'm not here to advocate that all of Minnesota's farmers need to go organic, but I bring this up to show that alternatives do exist and produce equivalent yields, even going as far as using organic practices. Now, I'm a person that cares about frogs and fetuses, and I see this as truly a pro-life or family values issue when farmers suffer from low sperm counts and feminization is induced through the use of atrazine. And as an aside, I'd just like to mention that I've inspected hundreds of farms in Minnesota and throughout the upper Midwest over the years. And I always like to ask farmers why they are interested, why they're converting to organic. And the number one reason I hear farm after farm is family health. Farmers have seen members of their own families die from cancer and seen high rates of birth defects in their neighborhoods. And they're tired of having to deal with toxic laundry. I've heard it time and time again from farmers that they want to be able to hug their children when they come in from the field. It's clear from the evidence that there are serious problems caused by atrazine. And to me, it's not a question of if, but when and how atrazine's use will be phased out. And you're our elected leaders. You must assess the best available science, and it's not going to be perfect science, but the best available science, and base the regulations and laws on the best evidence at hand. Restrictions on the use of atrazine are consistent with the governor's clean water initiatives, are in the best interest of Minnesota farmers and citizens. I close by saying that this is a public health issue that won't go away, regardless of what happens in the committee today. Your challenge is to minimize the negative impacts on Minnesota farmers while showing leadership and phasing out the use of a persistent toxin. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Mr. Riddle. If Jennifer, could you said you had one copy of another document?
Yes, it's a 10-year study by the University of Minnesota comparing organic and conventional practices showing equivalent yields and profitability.
Okay, thank you. Jennifer, if you bring that to the front here, and then if any members would like a copy of that, talk to Denise here, and you'll be able to get a copy of that. Thank you so very much. This is an interesting hearing for me in that I've never had one before where members haven't been able to ask questions, but we have given us several days, to the one side here, and I think we should get right into the other side.
Just have one comment.
Representative Magnus.
You know, I'm tired of getting beat up as a farmer. Yesterday I got called an old farmer, which had no evidence to it, I might add. The lady is not here. And now Mr. Riddle's telling me that my sperm counts are low. I'm getting kind of fed up with
it. Representative Magnus, I feel your pain. With that, let's get right into the opponents of the bills at hand. Mr. Doug Peterson, President of the Minnesota Farmers Union, will go first, and then President Christofferson of the Farm Bureau, Warren Formo, Jerry White, Kevin Doyle, Tim Pasteur, Alan Hosmer, Dan Stoddard. We went about 5 minutes over, so we'll give this side this exact same amount of time, and then we'll have it up for a vote. Representative Peterson. President, you moved up quite a bit here. President Peterson, welcome to the committee, sir, and if you could please present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Davis, Chairman Davis, and members of the committee. My name is Doug Peterson. I serve as president of the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a general farmers organization that has been active in Minnesota since 1929, representing farm families. I am here today and speak in opposition to the bills that we have already heard today that would ban either or phase out the use of atrazine in Minnesota by Minnesota farmers. And that is who I represent, in other words, the farmers of Minnesota. And I want to say also to you, kind of off my testimony here, our position also recognizes that this issue, if voted down today, was not going to go away. While Minnesota has a lot of concerns about these bills, the issue has risen to the surface with many of our members. We have polled our members during the first weeks of legislature, and I was surprised to find out the amount of number and members that use atrazine. If My members have commented to me that it was probably over-applied in years past, and we're probably have some isolated cases of even now when it is over-applied and where it happens. We at Farmers Union chose to focus on the positive. Our farmers that use atrazine are quick to point out that they live on farms and drink and use the water, as do their livestock and their neighbors, and that they are careful how to apply a chemical like atrazine to the land. Our policy does support research being aimed at moving away from having farmers being dependent upon pesticides and herbicides. I would also like to share with some of the other comments of the farmers members that we have. Many of our members have commented on the price of atrazine. The product is very economical, and in markets that are very tight, $2 corn, products that are economical do affect the bottom line. Many members that use no-till and low-till farming practices, which also can provide cover for the sequestration of carbon, which is good for the environment, tell me that atrazine is very useful, a herbicide for controlling broad leaves. Many farmers use atrazine in tank mix solution, or it may be an ingredient out of one ingredient of many that a farmer uses. In discussion with these issues, farmers of Minnesota Farmers Union tell us that they did not know at times they were actually using atrazine, only to find out later there were some investigations on their own that in some part there was atrazine in the tank mix or what they had bought. And one of our Farmers Union members has suggested perhaps a labeling all that would say this product contains atrazine as a way to highlight the product and its mixes. Farmers have worried that banning atrazine would put Minnesota at a competitive disadvantage with neighboring states. Farmers have told me they would support perhaps limiting the application rate per acre, and the most farmers I've talked to use less than 1 pound per acre, in many cases a half pound to 3/4 pounds per acre. Minnesota Farmers Union needs to investigate the further options, but perhaps this is a starting point. The farmers I've talked with also remind me that they do apply atrazine. They take tests and are certified by our Department of Agriculture, and they are quick to point out and show me their cards of certification, which I believe I'm not certified in chemical pesticide application because I don't know if I'll pass the test anymore. Okay? A little study may be involved. Farmers are also concerned about what their options are. So if they don't use atrazine, are there other products that will have to be banned? And I will tell you one thing our producers bring up to me, that is not being able to use atrazine, this will result in even more Roundup Ready or GMO type farming for many farmers. That is a very strong concern. Minnesota Farmers Union does not dispute that atrazine has shown up in wells, and we do support efforts to address those issues. And I would be remiss in saying that we do also have members that would support a ban or a phase-out, but we are not comfortable today, committee, with language in these bills. We are committed to continuing to visit and revisit this issue with our members, and I'm sure that this topic will be one at the of our future fall convention and our many county and state conventions. This is a product that many farmers have used for decades, and we are sure that policy that we are making will not be short-sighted, but be based on what the science comes up with. And just kind of off the record, you know, the past, really, you're never off the record. You understand that, Chairman?
I can tell
not
you.
Not here.
Especially when you're being taped. Yeah.
It's very hard, and I'm going to say this, it's very hard to pay for the perceived sins of the past for agriculture, based on what we know today. But it's pretty tough to go without choices and environmental tools to pay for the future and to be competitive in the future. I just wanted you to understand that, because you know, I can think of a million things, or not, maybe not a million, but there's a lot of things around the table that point to competition globally and other countries that are using it, country of origin labeling, inspection, all of those things all have to be taken into consideration as we move toward or even consider any kind of banning or reduced labeling. Thank you.
Thank you, President Peterson. We'll go with, if you could just stick around a second, we'll go with a couple questions. Representative Moe, you had a question for Mr. Peterson. Mr. Peterson, if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Just a quick question. I know the Farmers Union has a reputation for representing farmers that are great stewards of the land. They care, obviously, a lot about the health of the land and the people that work on it. My question is, you alluded to that this is a discussion that you're having currently amongst your membership. And you also talked about competition between Wisconsin, Iowa, perhaps. Has your organization thought about the competition from the perspective of quality of place? You know, we want to make sure our farmers are at a competitive advantage, or at least an even playing field. But Minnesota also has a reputation of being having a quality of place, a quality of life. People come here for fishing. They come here they locate their businesses here because of our clean air, clean water. They can fish. They can eat the fish. Is that part of the equation? The first part of the question. The second part is looking at the parts per billion that one of our bills is looking at. Has your organization actually looked at parts per billion in pesticides in the water? And have you talked about it in those terms? And what's acceptable, what's not acceptable for your membership?
Representative Moe, could you repeat the question?
Mr. Chairman, I think I got him.
Oh, you got it? Okay.
I think
okay.
So.
President Peterson.
Representative Moe, on the second question, have we considered the parts per billion in our policy discussion? No, we have not. On the first question, on the quality of place, that will be a discussion that we are going to bring forward to from our county conventions to our state conventions. And the discussion, I can tell you very strong, very confidently, that we will have, I think, a very spirited discussion at our state convention, which happens next November, about the role of not only pesticide of atrazine, but the use and how that applies to our quality of life in Minnesota. One must remember that Minnesota's resource is water, and that's very, very critical in this discussion and deliberation.
Thank you.
Representative Welty, and then we're going to go to the next witness. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, thank you for coming and testifying today and representing the Farmers Union. My question to you is, have you had individuals, scientists, doctors, and others come in to testify to any members of your organization, and have you taken up the issue of atrazine?
The question is no. Categorically no. Mr. Chairman, no.
Thank you. Okay, we'll now go. Excuse me. Representative Pettis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But I do want to add that quality of life, as we talk about in Minnesota, is kind of relative, because quality of life to me is being on my farm. Quality of life to you, Representative Moe, may be fishing and whatnot. And we are a very diverse state. So, I just think that we need to realize the other good point that was made by somebody today is change is very hard. I find that when I deal with the preservationist crowd every day. So, thank you.
Mr. Christofferson.
Thank you very much, Committee and Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Al Christofferson, President of Minnesota Farm Bureau, welcome to the Ag Committee, sir. And we've got seven folks left to testify, and we've got about 5 minutes apiece. And then we'll, about 4:15, we'll be taking up the vote. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to make some comments here, and my comments will be relatively brief.
Is it something I said?
It's like the Farmers Union bleeding.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. President. Please proceed.
I am Al Christofferson, President of the Minnesota Farm Bureau, and I'm also a corn and soybean producer in Kanawha County out by Pennock, for those of you who are pretty well familiar with the state. You know, we've heard a lot about the benefits and the perceived disadvantages with regard to atrazine, pro and con. as we see it, we need to cut to the chase. We need to cut to the chase. The question on the table today is, should this committee establish as a matter of public policy for the state of Minnesota restrictions on the use of atrazine by farmers that are more restrictive than any other state in the nation and more restrictive than the labeled requirements on atrazine currently approved by the U.S. EPA? Or go even further and ban the use and the sale of atrazine in Minnesota? Now, our answer as an organization and my answer as a farmer is no. Now, if your answer is yes, then what is next and where will it end? Will how we farm and the products that we are able to use be based on then political decisions? I don't think we want to go down that road. We must place, and we've got to place, our trust in the decisions made by state and federal agencies that are charged with protecting the health and the safety of our environment and our citizenry. Now, your committee has been placed in an unenviable position, and I would submit an unfair position. You are being asked to override decisions made by state and federal agencies who have spent years studying the data, convening scientific advisory panels, and they came to the conclusion that atrazine can be used by Minnesota farmers as long as label directions are followed. Now, just because some do not agree with that decision is not enough reason to try and override it on a statewide basis. The regulation of crop protection products must take place at the federal level, not decided state by state. We are asking that you allow Minnesota farmers the ability to continue to use crop protection products such as atrazine in the same manner as farmers all across the nation. And we certainly urge your support in defeating any legislation restricting and or banning the use of atrazine or any other crop protection products by Minnesota farmers that have been approved. In closing, I would like to say that while our immediate concern is the legislation before you dealing with atrazine, our bigger concern is what next. Those supporting this legislation have been quoted as saying atrazine is just a starting point for us. There will be more to come. Don't start down that road. We'd ask that you defeat the bills before you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Representative Welty, and then John King. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Christofferson, for coming in and representing the Farm Bureau. My question will be the same to you as it was to Mr. Peterson, and that is, have you brought in scientists, have you brought in doctors, have you brought in others to testify to members of your organization about the atrazine issue?
President Christofferson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, we have not. Here again, we have relied upon EPA, who at times I think we feel is perhaps overly restrictive, but nevertheless, that is the body in the land that has been charged with making sure that the proper registration is taking place and that the products are safe for the environment, and it's based on that that we make our decision.
Representative Johnke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe not a direct question, but a comment. Appreciate you being here. Always good to see my Candy Iconi residents out here, Mr. Chair, and especially the wise ones, Mr. Christofferson. I just want to point out one of the comments you made, and I think it's important this committee, is the politics of the issue. Because too many times in this place, and this is one of those issues I'm fearing that is getting dredged up in political reasons. You know, if you vote for atrazine, I'll vote for something else, I'll trade this vote for that vote, and these types of things, and we see that going on. Number one, that troubles me. Number two, a heads up, the other place where political realities come into play, members, and we heard the bill in Rules Committee the other day and actually passed it out, but I assume this group will pretty much join hands against it, was the initiative and referendum bill. And that's another bill that if that would ever become law in this state, you would see politics, particularly this type of politics, banning atrazine, Trump policy or science, because that's what that would become. And I just want to give you all a heads up. If and when initiative and referendum hits the House floor again this year, I would hope as rural members and ag members that we would help to fight that down again.
I think we're some junkies. Okay, our next person testifying, Warren Formo, Program Manager, Minnesota Corn Growers Association. Representative Heigerken.
Thank you. To that point here, and I just want to make a general comment, long as we were getting other members giving comments and haven't said anything on the matter. I'm looking at, I can listen so long, Chair, and after a while you have to say something. I'm looking at some of the studies they did. If you got handouts, there's a lot of wells in my district, just about half of them, that the Minnesota Department of Agriculture has monitored or seem to be my area. And on my wall in my office, I have a picture of my mom that was that made the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, among other areas. And they had done a study in Stearns County. And we have found that the women in Stearns County live longer than any place in the world. The average age expectancy of a woman is much, and I look at this, all this monitor, we got all this atrazine and everything else, you would think that they wouldn't live that long. But yet, the age expectancy in Stearns County is higher than for women than any place in the world. How do I explain that? And we haven't gone to the sperm count yet either.
Okay.
I come from I've got eight brothers and three sisters, and my wife I think has got, but it's 15. It's the family's around there. My neighbor had 22 children. I mean, it goes on.
There's so many things one could say right now. Would be best if they didn't. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Warren Formal, and I'm with the Minnesota Corn Growers from Granite Falls, representing the Minnesota Corn Growers here today.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I know that in interest of time, it would be good to be brief. So I've only got a couple points I'd like to make. I think that others have covered a lot of what I would have intended to cover relative to agriculture, but I would like to add a little bit to give you a clearer picture, and I know many of you are very close to agriculture, and this will not be a surprise to you, but you know that Minnesota farmers have a strong environmental ethic and strong environmental values. If we look at the entire agricultural system here in Minnesota, everything from tillage and crop rotations to crop protection product use, we see that farmers are doing a good job. Yesterday you heard from Jennifer Sass with NRDC, and she referred to a meeting she had recently with the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation. And many of you probably know that here in Minnesota we have a similar group, the Minnesota Agriculture and Rural Leadership Program, of which I graduated last spring. And she spoke of meeting with that group and how the farmers relayed to her that they would like to reduce pesticide and crop protection product use, how they use it at the appropriate amount and use the appropriate product at the appropriate time with appropriate methods. And I'd like to report, I'm glad to report, that Minnesota farmers are doing those things. You've heard already talk of our certification and training program for farmers here. Specific to atrazine, I think it's important that you know that the average application rate per acre of corn atrazine on corn in Minnesota is less than half that of Illinois, where we're told that the young farmers are doing a good job. I think the reason is probably that in Minnesota, the young and old farmers are doing a good job. So our farmers are doing the right thing. We've also heard a lot of things, a lot of statistics and facts, some of which have not been very clearly connected. And I guess I would simply report, much like Representative Heidgerken reported on some anecdotal evidence of some things going on in Stearns County. I know that in Chippewa County, back home, Representative Coonan, if we go outside in the spring on an evening and listen, we can hear frogs with their mating calls, many of them in deep voices. and they're doing what frogs do. They're doing the right thing, making little frogs. We have plenty of frogs. And so I would argue that if the situation were as dire as what we have been told, that would not be the case. You have some legislative proposals before you that would undermine the current system, and I would just echo what the last few speakers have said. We do have confidence in the current oversight system. We believe that it does properly manage crop protection products. It has been implied that Minnesota does not restrict atrazine use. Atrazine has a label. Farmers read the directions and follow that label when they apply atrazine. So atrazine is used properly in Minnesota. Finally, I would ask that now you do the right thing and vote no on these proposals at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cormo. Jerry White, Executive Director of Kansas, Chairman of the Triazine Network, Director of Kansas. What are you directing in Kansas?
I'm sorry?
What? Who are you? Jerry
White? I'm with
White.
The Kansas Corn Growers Association.
Oh, okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry White. I'm the Executive Director of the Kansas Corn Growers Association and here at the request of the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I'm a fifth-generation farmer stockman from East Central Kansas. I also serve as Executive Director, as I said, of the Kansas Association. In addition, I serve in a less formal role as Chairman of an ag coalition known as the Triazine Network. The Triazine Network is a coalition that was formed in 1995 by growers and users of atrazine from across the United States. Our members go from coast to coast and border to border, produce over 30 commodities, and operate out of over 30 states. So it's a very, very vast coalition, everything from corn to macadamia nuts, citrus, about every agricultural commodity that you can think of does have an interest in this special review. The objectives of the coalition were to ensure that EPA has and utilizes the best available science to conduct the special review. We also want to provide feedback to all parties regarding the potential impact on the farming community of any proposed changes and monitor the activities of the registrants in the process. So it was a communication process between growers and EPA and growers and the registrants and hopefully helping facilitate better decisions in the end. We support the atrazine re-registration process because we believe that EPA has largely used the best available science in their decisions. Minnesota growers, like those all over the U.S., rely on atrazine as a critical tool for effective and affordable weed control in corn. Atrazine is the most important herbicide used in conservation tillage, type of farming that is expanding across the nation, and in spite of being dismissed by Dr. Hayes yesterday as being insignificant in Minnesota, this practice addresses many other areas of environmental protection, such as soil erosion and wildlife habitat. It is truly ironic that the activists are busy in Minnesota suggesting that the process is severely flawed because of industry influence. In the last 10 years of the special review, our biggest complaint, although we support the overall process, is that we have not been included in all aspects of discussions. And it's certainly ironic that the activists are complaining of undue influence when, in fact, our biggest complaint in the public docket has been the undue influence of the environmental activists. And we've made those over the years into the public docket. They're crying foul now because the weight of scientific evidence does not support their predetermined outcome, and that's the end of atrazine. Make no mistake about it, and it's been certainly stated earlier this afternoon, it's not just about atrazine. I found it very telling that NRDC didn't have a position on things like biotechnology, and yet were concerned about the what they would consider excessive use of pesticides. Regardless of how you feel about biotechnology in Minnesota, there clearly is a link between increased use of biotechnology for insect control and less insecticide use. That is a fact. One of the things that Dr. Sass did discuss was all the litigation that NRDC was involved in. But what she forgot to tell you when she described that litigation, legal maneuvering, is that growers and registrants alike are locked out of that process when settlement decisions are being discussed. These documents then become drivers for the registration process rather than the original legislation and rules and regs like FIFRA. In other words, they enter into consent decrees through the courts, and those become the drivers in the next phase of what is to occur. Certainly, Dr. Hayes might be the most misrepresented scientist on Earth, at least according to Dr. Hayes. EPA and the Syngentans are somehow in cahoots, but in reality there are several registrants of atrazine, not just Syngenta. There were closed meetings during the process that were not open to NRDC. There were meetings that were not open to the growers. But I'd also add there were meetings that were held with EPA that included NRDC that were not available for the registrants or the growers as well. It's just part of the process that goes through a very complicated process, and it's just a way that you sort out the science and the confidential business information, not anything unique to atrazine at all. There's a 10-year history of undocumented secret meetings and communications on this issue at EPA, but of course I'm referring to the ones between NRDC, the Environmental Working Group, and other activists in EPA. In fact, Dr. Hayes seemed a little surprised to learn that his often bizarre communications with EPA were public, and yet he seems to complain about the lack of transparency and process. Mark Twain once wrote that there is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. And he could have been writing about the activists and atrazine. The weight of evidence supporting the continued safe use of atrazine has evolved over 45 years. The activist-fed frenzy over frogs, less than five. Dr. Sass and Hayes put on quite a show yesterday, and they told some big tales. The problem is they intentionally tried to mislead this committee. Others will address some of these issues, so I'll defer to them. But do you really believe that the U.S. EPA, under two administrations, one Democrat and one Republican, would disregard a real threat to human health and the environment? Do you believe that? I'll follow this process in detail for over 10 years. The ability to safely use atrazine was always key to the support from the farming community, including my members in Kansas. If there is a real problem, it is ours first and foremost. We live where we farm, as do our families. Not one time in 10 years, in meetings at all levels within EPA, has anyone informed me of a real risk to humans. A recent study of farm ponds in Minnesota, and I have a copy that I'll leave, I didn't want to burden you with copies for everyone, determined that ponds surrounded by row crops had similar species richness and reproductive success compared to natural wetlands. I'll assume that most of you live in rural areas like I do. I like to fish when I get a chance, and I can say with certainty that frog populations are doing fine in Kansas, where the majority of over 6 million acres of corn and grain sorghum are treated with atrazine every year. Are frogs missing in Minnesota? And I don't mean that you can go out and find a weird or a strange one every now and then, but when you go out and look, are they really missing where you expect to find them? If not, how could that be? Atrazine has been used for over four decades and at significantly higher historical rates than today. Dr. Hayes went to great lengths to suggest the linkage of frogs to fish to rats to chickens to humans. But the linkage that is certain, as confirmed by the Minnesota study, is that fish eat frogs. It's also in this report. Well, yes, humans eat fish. Sometimes they eat frogs, and they certainly eat chickens. So I guess there is a relationship in play. But the only confirmed fact relative to atrazine and frog population declines seems to take place in Berkeley as a result of Dr. Hayes and his scalpel.
Mr. White, how much testimony do you have left?
Just about that.
Three slides?
Yes, less than three slides.
I have to say she ain't Kansas anymore. One of my favorite movies.
He also showed you some of those victims yesterday on the slides. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today on behalf of my friends in Minnesota Corn. I respectfully suggest the premise behind these bills is severely flawed, and they should be rejected. And just as you sat through some of the discussions over the last day and a half, certainly there are some things that just I can't leave without stating. The gross misrepresentation, the one that was dealt with this afternoon, the continuing discussion of the human health standard and the violation of it. The fact is, and everyone probably that has used this term knows better, the 3 parts per billion maximum contaminant level established by EPA assumes 70 years of exposure for adult male at a certain level of consumption. So when you see a one-day exceedance, it's not an exceedance of an MCL. That's not what an MCL is. Do not be fooled by the misrepresentation of these things. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. And we love Kansas, by the way. Ambassador David's here. Okay. Kevin Doyle, if you could come down and just state your name, who you represent for the record, and you apparently agreed to go. I just want to get you on the record as to what your position is for the Minnesota crop production retailers. Then, two gentlemen from Syngenta, Department of Ag, and we're voting, so we're going to get this done. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, and what your position is.
My name is Kevin Doyle. I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers Association. We have over 500 members, 350 of them are retailers in Minnesota. We would ask that you would vote no on these bills.
Thank you for your testimony. Dr. Tim Pastor and Alan Hosmer, if you could please come down from Syngenta. And then Mr. Stoddard, and then we're voting. And we're voting, again, at the request of the authors of the bill. They wanted to vote today. Is there, we've got Dr. Tim Pastor and Alan Hosmer. Oh, that'd be fine. So, Dr. Tim Pastor, please state your name, who represents for record, please, sir, and welcome to the committee.
My name is Dr. Timothy Pastor from Syngenta. I'm the head of human safety for Syngenta. I have a PhD in toxicology from the University of Michigan, the other U of M, unfortunately not in the NCAAs this year. What I'd like to do, and make this very brief, because time is obviously the best gift that anyone can give. So I'm going to make my comments very brief, but I do want to state a couple of facts that are very important in the decision that you're about to make. And I can imagine how you must be feeling with all of the facts and figures and information that's floating around. How do you really make a decision on this? And I think the telling thing in all of this is that there is a worldwide review of atrazine, its health effects, and its ecological benefits as well. And the prepared presentation that I had, I'm obviously not going to do, but let me just read you a few of these things that were articulated by the Australian Review Board, by the European Union, other countries around the world, as well as our own United States Environmental Protection Agency, in coming to grips with the vast amount of data that's been generated on atrazine. And it's to give you a sense of comfort about the fact that this has been extremely well reviewed. Atrazine has been around for a very long period of time. There's been well over 800 studies, 200 done in the last probably 10 years, to develop a very good understanding of the human health aspects of atrazine. And based on that information, the EPA has rendered very clearly its judgment about that atrazine, number one, on the cancer question, is not classifiable as to carcinogenicity in humans. It's not likely to be a human carcinogen. The World Health Organization has also rendered that judgment as well, by saying that it's not classifiable as a carcinogenicity in humans. And one fact that I think that you also should be aware of, that there is a huge study going on right now called the Agricultural Health Study, looking at farm families in both North Carolina and Iowa. They're looking at a number of different health outputs in that situation. And in particular, they looked at the incidence of cancer. In this ongoing study where they're looking at farm families that have had atrazine use in it for quite a number of years, as well as a number of other pesticides, what they have concluded and published is that there is no association between cancer incidence and atrazine exposure. They further went on to look at prostate cancer, something that you've heard about before. Now, this is thousands of families that they're looking at. Data show no association between atrazine exposure and prostate cancer. The U.S. EPA looked at those findings and has also made a statement about prostate cancer. These and other additional analyses did not support, this is a quote, finding of association between prostate cancer and atrazine exposure. All of these slides are in your packet, by the way. Breast cancer, that's another one that you heard of yesterday. Looking at farm families in Iowa and North Carolina in the Agricultural Health Study, published in 2005, data do not show an association between atrazine and breast cancer. In addition to that, there's been a tremendous number of ecological studies that have been done. Fish, alligators, birds, reptiles. And I think you can take heart in the fact that this is a tremendous number of studies that have been reviewed extensively by EPA. These studies form a basis for their decisions that they have on the proper use of the material of atrazine by the Minnesota farm economy. And these studies have shown that there are no adverse effects expected with atrazine use as it currently is. The other fact, and I'm going to end on this, Mr. Chairman, and go to questions, is that the levels of detection for atrazine, where it's been detected, are extraordinarily low and getting lower. And one fact that I'd like to read here that's pretty interesting, I think, is out of 913 community water systems serving 2.4 million people on groundwater were evaluated, 99.1% of those samples evaluated were non-detects. Now, in addition to that, you saw a map of Minnesota earlier today, but there were not monitoring stations in southern Minnesota. The reason is there's no detects there. They gave up on looking at that because the soil is quite heavy, and they're not finding detects in that area. So with that, and understanding that there is a tremendous amount of work that's been done, let me just go to questions, if there are any on your minds, that myself or Alan Hosberg can answer for you today. I know we're limited on time, but I'd be more than happy to take questions.
Thank you, sir. Okay, with that, we will go to Mr. Dan Stoddard, Assistant Director of Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and then we'll go through the voting process here. So we will thank you, Dr. Pastor.
You're welcome.
And members, you've got a packet here with, I think, some of your testimony, or let's see here.
Yep.
The slideshow that you're going to show, everything's right there.
Yeah, everything's in the packet.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director of the Agronomy and Plant Protection Division of the Minnesota Department of Ag.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. And I'd like to briefly comment and express our concerns on the several bills that have been introduced on atrazine and also set the record straight in several different areas. Department of Ag is the lead state agency responsible for the regulation of pesticides. Given the regulatory structure that the Minnesota legislature has set up, Department of Ag does not have toxicologists or health scientists on staff. Department of Health is responsible for developing health standards for pesticides. PCA is responsible for developing surface water standards for pesticides. We defer to the PCA and Health for developing the standards. We are then responsible for taking action based on the standards that are developed by other agencies. I'd like to give a little bit of background on atrazine. As you know, it was first registered in 58. It's been in use for 47 years. It's one of the older products around. Atrazine is one of the most common pesticides used in corn, but it is fourth overall in volume. It is not first, as some have said. Acetochlor rates are twice as much than S-metolachlor and Roundup before atrazine. Atrazine is relatively mobile and persistent in the environment. It is frequently found at low levels in surface water and groundwater, where groundwater is vulnerable to contamination. Now, atrazine in Minnesota is used primarily in tank mixes. It is not used as the primary herbicide anymore. That is true in other states. Rates of atrazine, we have information on that from the Minnesota Agricultural Statistics Survey. In Minnesota, atrazine is used at much lower rates than in most other states. The average rate is about 7/10 of a pound per acre. Wisconsin, it's about 8/10 of a pound. Nebraska and Ohio, it's about a pound. In Illinois, it's about a pound and a half per acre. So we're actually using atrazine in Minnesota on average at less than half of what's occurring in Illinois, for example, based on what the previous speaker said. Department of Ag does monitoring of groundwater and surface water. We have, I think, a very well-structured long-term monitoring program. We did recently last year a drinking water survey, which is statistically defensible. We shot for 100 wells. We weren't able to get 100. We did 71, which still provides us adequate number for statistics. We found 10 wells that had atrazine or a degradative atrazine, and the average or the 90th percentile was 0.09 parts per billion. So atrazine can be found in the groundwater, but it's not widespread. It's not in every well. Also, there was a skew. We looked for wells that were vulnerable in that survey. So there's many wells that are deeper, finished in deep aquifers, and we didn't even sample those. So those are vulnerable wells. We also recently conducted a very detailed survey of pesticide use on the major crops in Minnesota. We surveyed almost 10% of all the farmers in the state, and that information is on our website. We have very accurate information regarding pesticide use if anybody's interested in that. Department of Agriculture, as I said, has been monitoring groundwater for about 20 years. We have focused now on the central sand plains. It's a long story to tell you how we got there, but basically we did it with the legislature's approval. We started statewide, and we found that any time we found something somewhere in the state, it was usually in the central sand plains or southeast Minnesota. So we focused on the central sand plains to optimize the resources. It's a very sensitive system. What we're reporting is essentially an early warning system. If you're going to find it anywhere, you're going to find it where we're looking. And so it's definitely worst-case scenario. We're also sampling in southeast Minnesota in both springs and surface waters, and we do find atrazine fairly commonly, but at relatively low concentrations. We have data from the central sand plains, 20 years of research that shows that the concentration is decreasing, and that's the concentration of the parent compound. But it's the 50th and 75th percentile has dropped significantly over the last 20 years. So we are having an effect, we believe. And the rates have changed. The rates of use have dropped significantly over the last 10, 15 years also.
Mr. Stoddard, I'm going to have to cut you off there. I've got one question for you. Does the Minnesota Department of Agriculture support the three bills before us?
No, sir, we do not.
Okay, thank you. Okay, with that, I will, our representative Ruth Johnson renews her motion. Representative Hamilton?
I call for a roll call vote.
Okay, roll call vote. We are on House File 1246. Representative Ruth Johnson renews her motion. House File 1246 be recommended pass and sent to the House General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
You broke it?
Gold point.
Here, you just move over.
Here, nobody listens to me anyway.
Be careful now.
And before she starts, members, this is not a past practice of mine, and it will not be a future practice of mine to so severely limit the questions of members, and I apologize for that, but I think you can understand what I have to do here. Okay.
David?
No.
Blaine? Finstead?
No.
Hamilton?
No.
Heidgerken?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Junkie?
No.
Coonan?
No.
Magnus?
No.
Moe?
No.
Otremba? Tennis?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Welty?
No.
Could you give me the title, please? Being zero ayes and 12 nays, the bill does not, or the motion does not prevail. We now have House File. Would anyone like to move House File 1248? Senator Welty?
I am not going to move it, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Chair, could I submit written comments afterwards in order for the time and everything? I did want to make a number of comments about what I've heard and why I'm basing my vote the way I am, but I don't feel that I need to take up the time at this point.
That would be much appreciated, and we will certainly take those for the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I'll move.
Thank you, Representative Welty, for that.
I move House File 1248.
Representative Johnson, House File 1248.
Mr. Chair. Over here. Roll call.
Representative Hamilton, a roll call has been requested. The committee legislative assistant. Oh, there's no official on this one. Oh, there. Okay, there's a fiscal note on both of them. I have one fiscal note that nobody else has, and it looks like it's about $16,000. $16 million? Oh, I forgot three zeros. Yeah, $16 million. So with that, Representative Johnson moves House File 1240 be referenced, passed and sent to the Ag and Environmental Finance Committee and Natural Resources. The Committee Legislative Assistant will take the role.
Davis?
No.
Blaine? Finstead?
No.
Hamilton?
No.
Heidgerken?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Junkie?
No.
Coonan?
No.
Magnus?
No.
Moe?
No.
Otremba? Hennis?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Welty?
No.
There being zero ayes and 12 nays, the motion does not prevail. We now have before us House File 1224. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, move consideration of House File 1224 with recommendation that it be laid over.
Mr. Chair, ask for a roll call.
Okay, the motion is to lay it over. Is that okay with the author? Okay, so we'll have a roll call.
To lay it on the table?
Vote on it?
Or to lay it on the table?
No.
She moved it. Now that's two motions.
Okay, it's the bill has been moved with the motion to lay it on the table. There could be a roll call on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Representative Hamilton requests a roll call, and this is to lay it on the table. So the motion is to lay House File 1224 on the table. The Committee Legislative Assistant will take the roll.
Davis?
No.
Blaine? Finstead?
No.
Hamilton?
No.
Heidgerken?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Junkie?
No.
Coonan?
No.
Magnus?
No.
Moe?
Yes.
Otremba? Hennis?
No.
Erdahl?
No.
Welty?
No.
Okay, there being two ayes and 10 nays, motion does not prevail. Now, we can either entertain a motion to... Well, what would the author like at this point? Representative Valgenius?
I appreciate your hearing the bill. I worry that it is the Agriculture Committee that has jurisdiction over our groundwater, because I do think we need to have some way of moving to protect it. That is, my only job here is to come to before you and say we have got to figure out some ways to protect our groundwater. We obviously haven't been able to do it today. I think there are other ways we could do it. I think we do owe that to Minnesota children.
Representative Wagenius, the bill is in the possession of the committee at this point. If you want no one to move it, we will just not move it, and it'll be in the possession of the committee, or we have someone move it and vote on it. But what would you prefer?
Fine.
Just leave it in possession of the committee?
I think we've heard the will of the committee.
Okay, so there'll be no motion on House File 1224. With that, good government all the time. Representative Allison.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to thank you personally for the committee hearing. I believe this has probably been one of the fullest hearings on this issue, and I want to thank every member and everything they had to say and all the close attention they played. And I just want to say that I think that Mr. Doug Peterson was probably most prophetic when he said that no matter what, this issue is going to be coming back. And this committee hearing has formed the basis of all of our education a little bit. And I would just urge us all to keep an open mind, and sometimes things continue to have life after just one session. So thank you again, Chair Davis, and thank every member of the committees, and thank all the testifiers and everyone who came.
Thank you, Representative Allison. Thank you, Representative Aguinas. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.